love music, live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pole Position on Rock Sport Radio. It's Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd. We're broadcasting live on DAB Digital Radio across Central Scotland on TuneIn and online, talking motorsport from 8 until 9. So, on the show this week, Hülkenberg let go as Ocon joins Renault, Rins makes it 2 after squeezing through, and Tanak takes a win that's vital with one hand on the rally title. All this and more on Pole Position. So Formula 1 is back after the summer break, with the action heading to Belgium for the 13th round of the season this weekend. And Adam, we've had some great races before the break, of course, and what better place to go to than Spa on Sunday?
Absolutely, it's great to be back after the 4 week summer break of Formula 1, and as you mentioned, at Spa, great track, proper old school track, and you'll not find a driver on the grid that's not looking forward to Sunday's Grand Prix. It's a fantastic, fantastic event in Belgium, and then you move on to Monza as well next week, so it's great after the summer break that you come in to two phenomenal and legendary tracks in Spa and Monza. And it's going to be exciting to see whether Red Bull, if they can take the fight to Mercedes, Max Verstappen in particular, can he follow up his form that he showed towards the latter half of the first half of the season, and whether Ferrari can join the party this weekend.
Absolutely, and of course, staying with Ferrari, Sebastian Vettel won this race this time last year, and incredible to think that that was his last victory for the Maranello team as well.
Absolutely, Kimi Raikkonen, the last driver to win a Grand Prix for Ferrari, says it all. Charles Leclerc, Sebastian Vettel, so much hope at Maranello at the start of this season, and we're still waiting for their first Grand Prix victory. I have to say, if it does not come at Spa or Monza next week, then they will be in an even darker place than they have been so far this season, which is saying something.
Now, there's been plenty happening away from the track this weekend ahead of the Belgian Grand Prix, so joining us on Pole Position to look at all the big stories, I'm delighted to welcome back Matthew Scott from GP Fans. Matthew, let's start with Mercedes, because Valtteri Bottas will be staying for the team for next season. What's your take on that?
Evening, guys. Yeah, I think Bottas staying at Mercedes was certainly to be expected, even though he had a couple of shonky results, shall we say, just before the summer break, not finishing in Germany and finishing down in eighth in Hungary. He's the perfect teammate for Lewis Hamilton. Let's face it. You know, you think back to 3 years with Nico Rosberg and the arguments and the stress and the headaches that Toto Wolff and the management will have had at Mercedes. The past 2.5 years have been the complete opposite to that, and they've kept winning. Hamilton's kept winning drivers' championships. The team have kept winning constructors' championships. And Bottas, you know, he's played his role in that. So not a big surprise that they kept Valtteri Bottas, even though he hasn't quite been able to match Hamilton. There's a little part of me that wonders if actually, you know, Mercedes might like that. I certainly imagine that Lewis Hamilton quite likes that as he closes in on title number 6 this year.
Matthew, I completely agree. You know, Valtteri Bottas suits Mercedes perfectly. It's perhaps not the fashionable appointment. You know, lots of fans calling for Ocon or calling for anyone really to really challenge Lewis Hamilton. My concern with Bottas is this, Matthew. 7 points separate just him and Max Verstappen in the Drivers' Championship. We're not... Valtteri's a good driver, but he's not in that top category for me, and I would like to think I'm not the only one with that opinion. Is there... What do you class as success for Bottas? Because, you know, if he gets second place, is he expected to do so with a comfortable margin? Because there's a real argument to say, if Max Verstappen gets a strong result here on Sunday, which is very possible because we know how much support he gathers for this race as well, Bottas dropping to third, that's not looking good for the Mercedes brand at all.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. And of course, had Lewis Hamilton not hunted down Max Verstappen in Hungary before the summer break, that would have actually already happened. I think you look back to even last season and Bottas not winning a single race. The fact that Mercedes kept faith with him then, I think, said a lot. You know, I don't think it damages Mercedes brand particularly to have one driver who is excellent and another driver who is quite good. You know, you think about the team that we probably all still think about as being one of, if not the best of all time in Formula One, was Ferrari at the start of the century, and it was exactly the same situation there, wasn't it? With, you know, an all-time great sweeping up all the medals, and a driver who was very, very good. You know, probably not on the same level in obviously Barrichello with Schumacher, and that is almost exactly, I guess, what we're seeing here now with Mercedes, and they're following that Ferrari template to a point that they're even now going to go beyond it. You know, this year they'll break Ferrari's record for consecutive title doubles, six in a row. So while that's going on, I guess there's no real reason for them to change a thing.
It's a very good point, Matthew. And that, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Ferrari there as well, because look where they are this year. They've got two drivers who are fairly evenly matched, and it's not worked out well for them at all.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned it at the start. You know, Sebastian Vettel now over a year without winning. I guess this race and the one next week in Italy might give him a chance to undo that. It depends on there's some upgrades around the grid that Ferrari don't have this weekend, so maybe that might be a factor this weekend. And you think back to the start of the season when you know we came away from sort of pre-season testing at the start of the year, and all the talk was Vettel's going to be, you know, he's going to pull level again with Hamilton. You know, Ferrari are back. Ferrari are the best team. And they still haven't won a race. You know, that is almost unthinkable. They've come very close on a few occasions. You know, that statistic doesn't quite tell the full story of their season, but it's been what we've almost become accustomed to with Ferrari. There's been individual mistakes, there's been team mistakes. And, you know, when the opportunity presents itself, as it does in these next two races, you wonder if they've really got the ability to capitalise on it.
Hi Matthew, Adam here. I have to say, you know, it's expected that Mercedes would retain Valtteri Bottas for next season, but I have to say I'm a bit disappointed in that decision, to be quite frank with you, because Mercedes, they've got to be targeting perfection. And as you mentioned, that last season, Valtteri Bottas, not a single race victory. He finished fifth in the driver standings behind both Ferraris, his teammate Lewis Hamilton, who of course won the championship, and Red Bull's Max Verstappen. And then here we are again talking potentially that Verstappen could beat Bottas despite Bottas being in a dominant car. And Bottas, he's not won a race since Azerbaijan. He was unlucky at Silverstone, but apart from that, you know, I just don't see where he's delivering really at the moment, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Like you say, it's kind of like the difference between what fans want and what the teams want, you know. The teams just want that sustained success, kind of however it comes. You know, we saw this, if you think back to last season, when Bottas had lost his chance to win, and, you know, there were team orders in Russia. And I think he said at the time then, you know, look, the team don't care what order the 1-2 is in. As long as there's a 1-2, the team are happy. So from the team point of view, that's how they see it. But yeah, I mean, as fans, you know, we'd all, you know, when was the last, it was Hamilton-Rosberg, wasn't it? The last kind of great, you know, intra-team battle that we've seen. And you wonder if the damage that almost caused, you know, Mercedes. I mean, they still won all the way through that because their car was light years ahead of the rest. But you think about some of the incidents between Hamilton and Rosberg. You know, if that was, you put those incidents into today's F1, and they wouldn't win all of those races, and, you know, Ferrari or Red Bull might take wins off them elsewhere, and it would probably cost them championships, and it would cost them race wins. So, as much as we'd love to see two of the heavyweights in the same team going at it once again, I don't think it'll happen for quite some time, because we've been reminded once again, you know, as we were in Ferrari, and maybe so many years of Ferrari dominating that way led to, I don't know, Hamilton and Alonso in McLaren, something like that. Or I guess we could have seen it this year with Vettel and Leclerc, but unfortunately Ferrari hasn't been good enough. But I would imagine that for a few more years to come, maybe we are going to see these one-sided team battles that actually think you see it quite, you know, even in the midfield, some of the teammate head-to-heads are quite one-sided. So I guess it's just the way that all of F1 is going.
And it's a difficult one to balance because we've gone through the pros of having a number one and a number two, and then we're also talking about Ferrari, who at the moment have two number ones in Sebastian Vettel and Charles Leclerc. And I said at the start of the year on this programme that I thought Ferrari, because at testing it looked really good for them, that they would win the Constructors' Championship, because I felt instead of Ferrari maybe having a 1-4 this season, it would be more 1-2s, and Leclerc, if Vettel wasn't performing, Leclerc would be able to take the wins. I mean, even Valtteri Bottas, I just don't see when Hamilton's not performing that Bottas is there to take points off the Ferrari and the Red Bull. And I think you alluded to it earlier on that the reason Mercedes are in this position where they've retained Valtteri Bottas is almost a luxurious position because they're not being challenged by Vettel and Leclerc, because if those two number ones were performing week in, week out and the car was up to scratch, then I think Mercedes might have made a different decision.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And very open and honest, I thought exactly the same as you at the start of the year. I thought that maybe, one team would win the Drivers' Championship and another team might win the Constructors' Championship, you know, because of the, like you say, because of the kind of consistency of results. But Ferrari, I guess, haven't really found that to come their way.
And it also pushes you to the next level, I think, as well, when you do have a really strong teammate. I mean, we're seeing at Red Bull, Max Verstappen, clear number one. The team is built around him. And then you look at the number two, Pierre Gasly, who, of course, has been replaced from this race onwards with Alex Albon. But, you know, Red Bull need a number two to deliver. So we do see that when you are in a tight battle, you do need, you know, not necessarily two number ones, but at least a driver who's there to take the points. And Red Bull are going to potentially lose out in second place in the Constructors' Championship because they don't have a strong driver partnered with Max Verstappen. And instead, they've built the team around Max Verstappen at Pierre Gasly's expense, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Red Bull example, they're a victim of their own previous success. You know, they're so stuck to promoting from within. You know, you think about their lineup last year. Actually, you talk about having two number ones, Max Verstappen and Daniel Ricciardo, that was two number ones, wasn't it? And, you know, they often pushed each other on. I know Ricciardo had a really tricky season last year, but to replace someone, you know, a Grand Prix winner like Daniel Ricciardo with, you know, a driver in his second year of F1 and Pierre Gasly, someone who'd had to wait quite a long time for that chance in F1, you know, he'd been in the background at Red Bull for a number of years. So maybe that explains why the pressure kind of got to him a little bit. Maybe he'd had to wait too long for that chance. Alex Albon, we have no idea, do we? I mean, he's so fresh in his F1 career. He's delivered some good results for Toro Rosso. He's delivered good results previously in his career. But as we've seen with Gasly, we would have said all that with Gasly at the start of the season, and he deteriorated. So I wonder if Red Bull actually, like you say, I wonder if the kind of this season might push them into breaking away a little bit from their model and choosing another driver from elsewhere on the grid to partner Max Verstappen. You know, there's a pretty experienced German one that's just come on the market today that they might be interested in.
And absolutely, Matthew. Let's move on to that situation there now. Esteban Ocon joining Renault for 2020, Nico Hülkenberg making way. Of course, we're expecting Ricciardo to stay there realistically. You could argue it is harsh on Hülkenberg, but Ocon's a talented driver who was harshly dropped and without a race seat in his own right.
Yeah, and he was harshly dropped because of the actions of Renault as well, who was supposed to sign him for this year, and then they got their heads turned by the chance to sign Ricciardo. Hülkenberg, he tweeted right up immediately after the announcement. You know, he obviously had this planned. He obviously knew well in advance, and he mentioned that the decision probably wasn't purely down to performance. So you wonder, you know, how much politics has played a role. I mean, politics in F1, but I mean even real world politics. You know, Renault are partly state-owned, so to have a French driver is probably quite a good look for them at a time where they need to, you know, make some good looks as well, because this year has been a very bad look for Renault. So, yeah, they've got the high-profile driver. They've now got a French driver who, you know, might be able to engage with the media a little bit more. Hülkenberg, though, he played a fantastic role at Renault. You know, they signed him in 2017, I think. I think it was the year after they came back into F1, and he saw off a couple of teammates there, really led the team. He was best of the rest last year, seventh in the championship. So there are, you know, there are a couple of seats still that could be free on the grid, and I would imagine that he's pretty much at the head of the queue for any of them, should teams be wanting a new driver.
Matthew, do you think Hülkenberg crashing out his home race in Germany was a decider here, or was this perhaps organised and arranged a good bit in advance? Because a lot of people hoping that would be the race where Nico Hülkenberg got his first podium in Formula 1, but it just wasn't to be.
Yeah, you wonder if maybe him, if he had kind of held on to it and he had got that podium, maybe that would have changed the way that things have gone. But you look back at things that Toto Wolff, Cyril Abiteboul, Bull, Esteban Ocon himself have been saying all year, and you can kind of sort of piece it together. You wonder, you know, this might have even been in the pipeline for a year, you know, since, you know, Wolff was kind of flagging off Abiteboul for breaking the gentleman's agreement, you know, by signing Ricciardo. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if actually this deal's been in place for a long, long time. And Hülkenberg may well have known that for that long, long time as well. So, you know, I'm sure he's had enough time to put his own plans in place to stay in F1 next year if he wants to.
And just finally, Matthew, anyone else you'll be keeping an eye on this weekend?
Well, I guess at McLaren, they've been, you know, they're really pushing towards the top three. Well, or they were pushing towards Pierre Gasly in the second half of last season. I wonder if they can keep that up. I think Renault are going to bring another upgraded engine, as are Honda, to this race, which Alex Albon will take and drop to the back of the grid on his Red Bull debut. So don't expect a Verstappen-esque debut from Alex Albon. But Carlos Sainz, the season that he's been having, and, you know, Spa, quite a high-speed track, and McLaren's been really good in a straight line this year. So I wonder if he might have another big result from him. Also, another one to keep an eye out for, we might, who knows, see Marcus Ericsson back in a Formula One car this weekend. Kimi Raikkonen's got a leg muscle injury, which he picked up playing sport over the summer break, said that drinking beer would have been safer. So he's going to try that out in practice tomorrow, and we'll see. If he's not fit, then Marcus Ericsson will return, having given up his IndyCar seat for the weekend, which long-term could be an interesting decision for him as well.
Matthew, great to chat with you again on the show. Thanks very much for joining us here on Pole Position.
Cheers, guys. Have a good one.
That's Matthew Scott from GP Fans there. And stay with us as we talk all things MotoGP up next on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Now moving on to MotoGP, and it was Suzuki's Alex Rins who came out on top in a thrilling race at Silverstone, beating Marc Marquez with a stunning move on the final corner of the final lap. Joining us to look back on an epic British Grand Prix is Lewis Duncan from Autosport. And Lewis, thanks for joining us as always. What a great advert for MotoGP that race was.
Stunning Grand Prix at Silverstone, 13 thousandths of a second split Marc Marquez and Alex Rins at the finish line. That is the fourth closest Grand Prix finish in the Premier Class history. It was a stunning event and, you know, much needed for Silverstone after, of course, the events of last year where the race was cancelled because of problems with drainage and the new track surface. So, yeah, brilliant, brilliant race. And, you know, back-to-back races where it came down to the final corner. I mean, this is the halcyon period of MotoGP that we live in right now, and it's just utterly, utterly joyous to witness.
And before we discuss the race in more detail, I want you to pick up in the comments there about obviously the cancellation of last year's British Grand Prix, because there seems to be a lot of talk about the attendance figures for this race. So what do we know about that, and what do you put those fallen numbers down to?
Well, yeah, definitely last year's events won't have helped, ticket sales this year, of course. You know, it happens with any event. If you've got a bad year, whether it's with weather, whether it's, you know, things outside of the circuit, like traffic management, you know, parking, things like that. There's been a couple of British Grand Prix at Silverstone for the Formula One that have had spectator fall-offs following years from, you know, logistical things like that. So that won't have helped. You know, really pleasant August bank holiday. People have gone, you know, gone away on holiday, that sort of thing. And, you know, there was a classic TT as well in the Isle of Man over the past week, so you have to think that quite a lot of the UK bike fans would have went to that, you know, in the celebration of, you know, machinery from a bygone era. Some, you know, you don't get to see racing like that anywhere else in the world. So I think it's a combination of those things. You know, 50,000-ish on race day is not a bad figure. It's roughly the same as what it was in 2017. So from that perspective, there's not been a massive drop-off. But Silverstone's got a deal for next year. They just need to market it a bit better. It's still on the August bank holiday weekend, which Silverstone are quite happy with. I don't know if that necessarily works best for it, because, you know, being Brits on bank holidays, we like to go away other places. So maybe a date change is needed. But I think next year, given how good this race was, given everyone's seen that the track works, the new track surface, works, then, you know, I think the numbers will be boosted next year. And of course, there is also the potential caveat that Valentino Rossi, that could be his last season next year. It could be Cal Crutchlow's last season next year. So if that does prove to be the case, that'll definitely boost spectator figures.
Now, Alex Rins has put in some sensational performances this season, but what steps do Suzuki need to take, and Alex Rins himself, in order to put forward a championship bid?
Well, I think Rins himself is almost championship worthy. He just needs a few more races like that, pretty much. But we've seen already this year in Austin and Silverstone how he was able to absorb, you know, the pressures that were exerted on him. At Austin, it was, you know, having to fend off Valentino Rossi. At Silverstone, it was it wasn't as if this was a race where it was dictated by tyre wear, where it was a slow pace. Marquez was pushing the whole time because he was trying to thin out the lead group so that his potential loss to his championship lead was minimal. So the pace was hot the whole race. You know, the best laps were 159.9 for both riders. They were regularly in those low 2 minute second laps, so 2 minute 0.00 laps. So the pace was hot, and Rins had a couple of moments, but he bounced back from it. He used the strengths of that Suzuki, that corner and, you know, performance that has, the braking stability, to, you know, counteract the power that the Honda has, to reel in Marquez, and obviously looked after his tyres better. So he's proven that in those situations he can handle the pressure. He just needs to show that a couple more times before going for a championship battle. As for Suzuki, they are almost there. The bike's really, really good. That, you know, the fact that they won at Silverstone really did prove that. Given that Rins never really looked capable of doing that all weekend until it got to the race, the one thing that will definitely help Suzuki is if they can get themselves a satellite team. You know, the more bikes you have on the grid, the better development you can do. You know, we've seen that with Honda. We've seen that with Ducati. We've seen that, you know, even KTM now and Yamaha. So from Suzuki's point of view, that's something they need to look into, and they are looking into, but there's nothing they can do about it really until 2021, when the current contracts between teams and manufacturers runs out. So it's one thing they need to look into, but Suzuki and Alex Rins are almost there. I think if they can just carry on how they're going right now, the way the development's going, next year could very well be the big one for Suzuki.
and Andrea Dovizioso, who's second in the championship on his Ducati. He was involved in a nasty crash in the opening lap. He was transferred to hospital, so gives an update on his condition now, and has he fully recovered from the incident?
He was taken to Coventry Hospital after the incident. He was complaining of some memory loss, but Ducati manager Davide Tardozzi told us after the race that he hadn't broken any bones. It was just a mild concussion he suffered, and he was discharged from hospital that same night. He flew to Misano for the test, which got underway today, and he was passed fit at the circuit, so he's all good. Still a little bit stiff, but that's to be expected from such a heavy incident. Fabio Quartararo also had a mild concussion, but he was on track at Misano today as well. So both riders involved in that one, thankfully, okay, and will be absolutely fine going forward to the San Marino Grand Prix in a couple of weeks' time.
And Luis Jorge Lorenzo returned at Silverstone. What did you make of his performance?
It was to be as expected. He wasn't going to set the world on fire. We know how good Lorenzo is around Silverstone, but his back injury that he picked up in Aston, it needs at least another month to fully recover. He'd missed four races, plus, of course, there was a summer break thrown in that in there as well, so he's had a lot of time off the bike. And, you know, the best exercise for a MotoGP rider is to ride a MotoGP bike. There's just nothing that can replicate that. And, of course, Lorenzo hasn't been on any form of motorcycle, so it was always going to be a tough weekend, but he gritted his teeth, he fought through the pain barrier, and he came away with 20 full race laps under his belt, a few practice sessions under his belt, so a lot of mileage there, and a couple of points. Not a bad effort, all things considering.
And Britain's Cal Crutchlow, he finished sixth in his home race. And there was some interesting comments throughout the weekend from him about the pain that he constantly goes through daily. And you mentioned earlier that potentially next year could be his final year in MotoGP. So what's the mood and atmosphere around Cal Crutchlow's camp at the moment?
Well, I spoke to Cal before the British Grand Prix, and I asked him, you know, do you still feel that next year could be his last? And he told me physically, you know, it does seem that way, but mentally he wants to carry on. He's still fast, he's still competitive, but he does, of course, have that pain that he's suffering from past injuries, but particularly in his ankle that he badly broke in a crash at Phillip Island last year. But, you know, he can't really gain much, look into the Silverstone weekend as any sort of indication of how he might decide, you know, that his future. He said to me that it'll be the end of this year, start of next year, how things get on there, that you'll eventually take that decision. Personally, I think he probably will carry on. I mean, he might be in pain, but he's still quick, and if he can guide the development of next year's Honda through the winter, which he missed out on doing last year, and that's arguably hindered Honda this year, if he can get that bike back to a position where he's more comfortable on it, then, you know, I think that'll be a factor in him making that decision. But, you know, he's not given up. It's obviously a question he was asked a lot, but it's not something he's dwelling on right now. But it's one of those situations we just need to see how the end of the season goes, how the winter goes, how the start of next year goes for that to become clear. But personally, I think he probably will carry on into 2021. He told me that a new deal with Honda has been discussed. So, you know, a deal will probably be there for him if he wants it. So, again, it'll just come down to what he feels he can physically cope with. But I think he will carry on.
And Lewis, finally, quick word on Yamaha, third and fourth. Will they be satisfied with that?
Yes and no. I mean, third and fourth, decent result. Rossi had a tyre problem from lap one, so that ruled him out of the podium fight pretty quickly. Vinales got sort of caught up in that turn one incident. A couple of riders had to roll off there, and Vinales just sort of got caught up in that, and that broke him, just bridged that gap between himself and Rins and Marquez. And his pace was identical to the top two, but that was his problem. He got to within 1.5, 1.7 seconds, just hit a brick wall. And, you know, even towards the end of the race when Rins and Marquez started fighting, he wasn't really quick enough to become a credible threat. I think they'll be a little disappointed, but the comments are generally quite positive from both Vinales and Rossi. You know, they feel they're a lot happier with the bike. Rossi's said again over the Silverstone weekend that, you know, things he's been asking from Yamaha for the past 2 years, he's now finally getting. They've been working really hard over the summer, and it now seems that Yamaha are really fully pointed in the right direction. So it's just a case of building on all the steps are taken now and putting that to information, all that data, and putting it all together for the 2020 bike, which again they were testing today at Misano. So they've already got an eye on next year, and it does seem like they are just heading back into that realm where they can be championship contenders. But on the other side, they did watch Fabio Quartararo for the whole weekend. Looked like he was going to threaten to win that race before the accident. So still a bit of work to be done there from the two work team riders before they're, you know, fully capable of winning races on a regular basis.
Lewis, thanks very much for joining us on the show. Always a pleasure to chat MotoGP with you.
Yeah, thanks guys.
Lewis Duncan there from Autosport speaking to us here on Rocksport Radio.
Okay, let's head to Ibrox now for the halftime report from the Europa League qualifier between Rangers and Legia Warsaw with Bob Smith.
And it's a halftime. Rangers 0, Legia Warsaw 0. A gilt-edged chance fell to Arrivo, driving wide of the post from a Morelis layoff right at the start of the game. Jack then crossed an exquisite ball into the box. Morelis guided past the post with a header. It really was a terrible miss. Legia were proving to be a formidable opponent, snapping at the heels of the Jers players every time they posed danger. Midway through the half, no side could make claim they held the upper hand, although the Jers looked more dangerous in attack. Rangers were still looking for that passage of play that would bring that elusive first goal, but try as they might, it just was not happening. Then nearly a shocker for Rangers, Legia's Lukakranis run into the box, bringing out a great save from McGregor. Rangers' final ball was not proving to be as dangerous as demanded by Gerrard, and one of the main reasons the Jers went into the interval not having scored any goals. This is Bob Smith for Rocksport Radio Ireland, where it fits a half-time, Rangers 0, Legia Warsaw 0.
Thanks for that, Bob. All right, moving on to the rally stage now, and it was a great weekend for Toyota. We thought Tanak taking his fifth win of the season at Rally Deutschland last weekend, finishing ahead of Chris Meek, his teammate, and Jari Matti Latvala taking that final step on the podium. Now, joining us on pole position to talk more about the event is, of course, rally expert David Halley. David, another great performance by Tanak. How many times have we said that this year? But what was it that impressed you most from him last weekend?
Just keeping his head while all others were losing theirs, I think, is the short answer. He just has an assurance about him at the moment that he knows he can do it. He's just, yes, he had a bit of a fight early on and until others had punctures, but he just kept it going. And yeah, Toyota 1-2-3, Tanak brilliant, Meek managing to behave himself and bring it home in a brilliant second place. And Jari Matti coming home third as the worst of the Toyotas, believe it or not. But there you go, third place. It's a brilliant event.
David, Tanak's now 33 points clear with four events to go. How does he manage this situation now? Because, you know, in circuit racing, if you're running away with things, you just back off, you manage to pace the gap between you and the chasing pack. How does Tanak, and indeed rally drivers in general, do the same thing here? Because it's a very different style of driving, of course.
It is, and with these cars, when you're not driving them on the limit, they are horrible things to drive. They don't respond. They need to have a decent amount of speed about them to perform well. In years gone by, there was timings available to the drivers within the stage. That was taken away a few years ago. So the drivers have to judge where they are. But you look at these stages, and the top guys, they're tenths of a second away from each other driving over the same piece of road 4 or 5 minutes later. How they manage to do that is beyond normal mortal thinking. They are just so good at it. But I think the biggest telling thing of the whole weekend was the run over the last stage, and just prior to that Sebastien Ogier was interviewed and he stated he couldn't drive the car, and that just says an awful lot to me.
Yeah, definitely, and a disappointing weekend overall for Citroën, which we'll come on to, David. David, I want to get your thoughts on Meek here, you mentioned to getting that podium there. How important do you think that result was for him? His first of the season, of course, in the grand scheme of things with Toyota, because, of course, team boss Tommi Mäkinen, far from happy with not just Mikko Latvala, of course, as well, last time out in Finland.
Yes, the two of them had to appear in the headmaster's office with their jotters down the back of their trousers. They just went chasing Tanak and both caused problems to themselves. This time they behaved, and that is a very, very telling result for Chris. He can get the car to the finish. I think he probably will understand that his teammate Tanak is going to be favoured at this point in the championship, being that far ahead. So if he can keep coming in second and putting in results there to back up Tanak, it takes points away from Neuville and Ogier every time he finishes ahead of them. But behind Tanak, it just allows Tanak to stretch his lead if they're in that position again. And last year in Turkey, now Chris didn't do Turkey last year. He was sitting out, having been sacked. But Tanak won it with the old engine. We will recall he had to pair an engine up, used an old engine in Turkey, because Turkey's not about outright speed. Turkey is about being clever and getting to the end with the car in one piece.
No, absolutely. And David, looking at Toyota in general now, still 8 points behind Hyundai in the manufacturer's standings, of course. Another strong result, yes, last weekend. But, is it? What do they do to try and close this gap? Because we know that car is the quickest out there. But I dare say what history has shown is it's perhaps not the most reliable as we go into events like Turkey coming up next.
The car is the quickest, but not by a huge margin. All the cars are very quick. When you look at Pertti Mäkinen, had a dreadful start to the event, and Germany had a broken wire, the car failed. He gets second fastest in the power stage. So all the cars are there or thereabouts. It all does come down to very small margins and silly things happening. Both Neuville and Ogier had punctures, which in an event where otherwise they would be tenths apart, suddenly you're over a minute down. Neuville and his co-driver managed to change a puncture in 1 minute 15 seconds, which is pretty good going. Yes. Not quite Grand Prix standard, but they were doing it themselves with a nut gun and a jack. There was no four people at each corner dealing with it.
And David, I tell you, it was a good scrap between Neuville and Tanak early on as well, but what impressed me about that tyre change is the pressure that these guys are under. You know, it's not as if, it's obviously comes out of the blue. They've got to react quickly and get that car back on the road. And to do it in that timescale is absolutely incredible.
They do get a notification that the cars do have tyre pressure sensors on them, and they do get a hint that the tyre is going down. They have to make a decision as to whether that tyre is going down fast enough that they're going to stop and change it, or they have to have a discussion amongst themselves about how close they are to the end of the stage before they even think about leaping out the car and changing it. If they're only a mile away from the end of the stage, they might lose 10 seconds by driving slightly slower on the puncture than they would do spending even something as short as a minute and a quarter changing the wheel. But they do practice it. They do practice that kind of thing, leaping out the car. All the tools are handy, and they can get to them. The boot where the spare wheel is lined with very slippy plastic material so that the wheel slides out quickly. They're not having to fight the wheel out of the back of the car. The old one will slide back in again and be located. It's quite a clever system that they use to make sure if they have to do it, they can do it as quick as possible.
David, let's take a look at Danny Sordo finishing fifth overall. It's a shame after some troubles early on as well. That's his first outing for Hyundai since taking that win in Sardinia. It was a shame because I was looking forward to seeing how he was going to get on there. I thought he had a real chance of disrupting the Toyotas.
Again, very good at the start of the event, but the Toyota just ganged up on them. Basically, it was gang warfare, and again showing great skill and perseverance, but just didn't get the result. It's a shame, but yeah, he's still got the speed. He's not slowing down any.
David, before we take a look at Citroën and M Sport, I just want to move away from the action briefly for a moment and just get your thoughts on the Mads Osberg situation with the spectator falling from height and into the path of Osberg's car, just getting out of the way in time as well. not get too great to see. You know, and the FIA has made a big song and dance about spectators watching the rally safely, and then we get another sort of incident related with a spectator and a very fast oncoming car.
It's horrible to watch, and we will remember a couple of years ago in Monte Carlo, a spectator fell off a high cliff just as Hayden Padden went off, and unfortunately the spectator perished at that point. It's in this country we possibly go completely the other way, and we have designated spectator areas and marshals looking after those designated areas, and a lot of rally fans object to that, but those spectator areas that we set out in this country are set out because they are safe places to stand or sit. When you've got so many spectators, it's almost impossible to marshal them all and keep them all in one place. And it can be as daft as just losing your footing and suddenly you're at the side of the track with a car coming. It's horrible to see, but it's very difficult to mitigate against with that number of people.
David, is there anything the FIA can do here? Because you mentioned the spectator areas, and I appreciate there are challenges when you have such well-attended events. But I think back to earlier in the year when we had the likes of Chile and how that event went down and how successful it was as well, of course. Is there, you know, can the FIA step in, and indeed will they step in, given how close that situation was, shall we say?
They have to be seen to be doing something. Quite what that something is, I don't know myself. We have this huge number of spectators, and that's the whole point of the event. It's all run and put on as a tourism event and bring people to it and let people see these phenomenal cars taking part. But trying to keep people safe is very difficult. In Finland, they actually employ, as well as marshals, they employ the army and some very large, fierce dogs to keep people in line, which works incredibly well. But there's quite a cost to the organisers involved in that kind of thing. And trying to balance the running of the event, the cost of running the event, to the benefit of the event, it's a very difficult balance to do. And these events are running fairly close to the margins anyway, so to put another huge cost in would just mean the organisers were going to be running at a loss, and the event wouldn't happen.
David, let's talk Citroën now. A very disappointing weekend for them overall. Seb Ogier, let's start with him. 7th place in that event, drops him to 3rd in the driver standings as well. He's now trailing Thierry Neuville by 7 points. You'll be bitterly disappointed with that.
Bitterly disappointed, but absolutely exasperated with the car.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, the last stage, he was interviewed for television, and there he is saying that he cannot drive the car. He's just finding that car incredibly difficult. I think that holds Chris Meek in very good stead. He struggled with that car last year, ultimately ending up with a big accident, trying to keep up with the pace. Sebastian's probably a little bit better than Chris, and maybe it's slightly less hungry in terms of the result. So he's going to screw the nut and drive it within its limits. But he only got that position because Lappi fell back to allow him to have that position. He was further back than that. So, very disappointing from their point of view. And if he's struggling to get that car to do what he wants to do this late in the season, it doesn't bode well.
David, we've spoken on length on this show about just how challenging that Citroën car seems to be to drive. Does that indeed underline just how impressive Ogier has been in spells this year? Because, of course, not he took that win in Monte Carlo, backed that up with another win in Mexico, second in Corsica, and some podiums in between there as well. Yes, he's had a couple of bad results along the way, but if a driver like Seb Ogier is struggling to get a tune out of that Citroën, there's something seriously wrong.
I would have said so, and obviously Lappi has had a similar problem. He's not of the same class as Seb. We know the class of Seb, 6-time world champion. You don't get to that level by not being good. Yes, he's had some very, very good cars underneath him, but this particular car seems to be... It's an inconsistency, I think, is what's happening with it, and that's the nightmare scenario from a driver's position. You want the car to respond the same every time you turn the wheel. If the when he had his accident a couple of events ago and whacked a stone on the inside of a corner that he knew was there, that corner was on the shakedown, and the car just did something he wasn't expecting. It turned in faster than he had otherwise expected and caused him the problem. So I think it's a lack of consistency in the car. And when you're travelling at those speeds and... You know, particularly in Germany with the on the Panzerplatte with the big Hinkelsteins at the side of the road, you do not want to be sliding into a Hinkelstein at speed. Certainly not, because the Hinkelstein will not give. It's designed to keep a tank on the road. It will just rip a rally car apart, as we've seen in the past when people have hit them.
Hmm. David, we mentioned Timo Suninen earlier. His rally never really got going after stopping with that broken wire early on. I have to be honest, I feel sorry for Timo, because that's two events on the bounce now where things haven't really gone his way. You know, I rate Timo very highly. I think he's a great prospect. And it's just one of those ones where it's unfortunate because, of course, Elfyn sitting out again. It's two events where we're expecting Timo to go and lead, and things just haven't really landed for him.
Absolutely. These things do happen in the world of motorsport, and it's unfortunate. It was a broken wire that wasn't discovered during the shakedown or any of the testing. It just reared its ugly head at that particular moment on the first morning, and that just put him on the back foot for the rest of the weekend. But he kept going, and although 29th, I think he ended up, or something daft like that. He was setting times and learning the car still, and learning the stages for next year. He was just keeping going. There was no point in him parking the car. The car was there. He was there. He might as well give it everything he could on the event and learn from it. And second fastest time on the power stage. He's still learning, but he's there or thereabouts.
And David, just finally, a word on Gus Greensmith, his first tarmac rally, of course, in a world car, finishing ninth in the end, but some you know, real promising signs in there, I felt. I think he was fifth in one of the stage ends as well. Again, it's just one of those opportunities for him where he can get, crucially, some more seat time in a world rally car and just show everyone what he's capable of.
Absolutely. It's how you learn. It's what happens. He's got this opportunity. Unfortunately, the Elfyn back was still too badly damaged to allow him to do the event. Gus hadn't done a tarmac event in the car. He'd done a couple of gravel events. Put him in the car. He tested well in the car. He seemed to be enjoying the car and getting more comfortable with it. But the step up to a world car from an R5, the cars are considerably lighter, considerably more powerful, and with much more aero on them. So it is an entirely different driving style required. The tarmac cars sit much closer to the ground. You're getting a much better aero effect from the underbody on it. And, it's all learning. And he is learning, and he kept it sensible. He was, as you say, he was there or thereabouts. He wasn't too far away from the top times, but he kept it sensible and brought the car home and maintained M-Sport's long-running points finish record.
So, David, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us here on Pole Position.
We didn't actually mention that you picked Seb to win.
No, well, I was trying not to mention that, David, you know. Doing so well there. You know, the reason I picked Seb is I thought, I'm chasing you in the stands, I know 3-1 down, and let's be honest, it's going to be very difficult now, I fully acknowledge that. But I thought, you know, Seb's the sort of driver where you pull it out of the bag when you expect it most, but... You know, it's just one of those things with that. Citroën, you know, we know he's been trying to make some changes behind the scenes. Citroën, of course, brains some upgrades as well. But, you know, it's a real, as we said earlier, it's one of those ones where if Seb Ogier can't get a tune out of that car, there's something seriously wrong.
Absolutely. And I'm sure you would have taken aught as well if I hadn't taken aught at the start anyway. So, yes, I think we're probably going to have to agree that Ott's going to be in the pound seat for most of the events for the rest of the season, and if he's not, he's had a problem that's not necessarily his making.
Yes, that sounds like a plan. We'll exclude Ott, and that will maybe give me half a chance of catching up with you then. David, thank you very much as always for your time.
Not at all. Cheers now.
That's rally expert David Halley there.
Now let's find out the latest from the Scottish scene by getting the Superfast Scotch Roundup with Glenn Alcock.
Hi guys, hello to everybody who's listening. So a few things just to get through tonight. So Jim Clark Museum, the official opening of the new museum today. So Jackie Stewart was there with Alan McNish. very emotional day for Sir Jackie, and there was a lot of people attending, including Christiane Ireland, who is the daughter of the F1 driver Innes Ireland of the 1960s, who was a real character, if you know anything about him. If you don't, then research him, because he was our sort of version of James Hunt. His daughter's a bit of a character as well, but that's another story. The Lotus Evora competition closes tonight at midnight as well, so you've still got the chance in the next few hours for £20 to win that really limited edition Lotus and support the Jim Clark Trust. Talking about Sir Jackie, there was also a Lark Hall Race Against Dementia, which is his charity that he's very passionate about. Endurance race on tonight, and it was the Scottish Motor Racing Club team that won it. The team comprised of Jordan Gronkowski from Formula Ford, Sandy Mitchell, who we'll talk a little bit about in a minute or so, Robbie Dalgleish and Ryan Smith. So that's really a great job from those guys. So well done. Sir Chris Hoy will be taking part in the Gymkhana Grid European Gauntlet Finals on September the 7th. He's going to be driving a Hyundai i20 R5 rally car, and he'll be going head-to-head with rally stars like Ken Block and Petter Solberg. So good luck to Sir Chris. Wallace Myers, so he took the British Hill Climb Championship title with 3 rounds remaining, so that's another great story from this week for Scotland. Sandy Mitchell, so I just mentioned him a minute ago, so he's got a 3rd place in the States when he was in his Lamborghini Huracan in the Lamborghini Super Trofeo North America race in Virginia, and in race 2 he was 3rd in his class. We've got the Bowness Revival this weekend, and they'll be paying tribute to Jim Clark because it's the 60th anniversary of him taking part in the hill climb. So he took part in 1959, competing in 3 different cars and setting the fastest time of the day. So there'll be several classic Lotus single-seaters on show and cars dating back to the 1920s for the hill climb. Formula Juniors will also be competing on the Saturday, and then they'll be moving on to Knock Hill on Sunday for the SMRC. Johnny Adams, so he's got WEC this weekend at Silverstone in his new Aston Martin GTE. And Colin Noble, we've talked a bit about him. So European Le Mans Series this weekend at Silverstone 2. So he's competing alongside teammate Tony Wells, and he'll be hoping to go one better than his second in class last year in the 4-hour race. Finlay Hutchison, he's been named a BRDC Rising Star. He's only 19 years old, so that's a great honour for such a young driver. And he's currently racing the Black Pan GT World to Challenge Europe and is competing in the Nürburgring this weekend. And for me and a lot of other drivers, it's SMRC, so back to reverse direction this weekend at Knock Hill. There's going to be a lot of action on track, so things will be kicking off about 8:35 on Sunday morning, and the races will finish at 6:10 with the Formula Junior that I mentioned. In Formula Fords, the Jordan Gronkowski only needs 4 points to take the title, so that could be wrapped up this weekend. But we did have some sad news this week as we said goodbye to Martin Ramsay from Shetland, who sadly passed away after battling an illness over the last few months. So he was a bit of a revelation in his first full season in 2018 when he won all the XR2 races and set the fastest laps in both directions, and he took the XR2 title. So we're hoping to honour him this weekend by getting his car out on track, and I'm sure all the drivers will be thinking about Martin and his friends and family at this sad time.
Oh, absolutely, Glenn, and thanks very much as always for your time here on Pole Position.
Thank you.
That's the Superfast Scots Roundup there with Glenn Alcock. So that's just about us for tonight, Adam. I have to be honest and say I'm still left reeling here after my prediction from Rally Deutschland last weekend.
We were just talking about it, and I said, well, you started off saying Oktanak's going to win it, and I said, why didn't you choose him? And you said, because I thought he was going to win.
No, I know, right.
I mean, that's no way to do the prediction games. No wonder you're losing here.
Right, but when you're chasing the game...
You're not helping your cause.
No, but when you're chasing the game, you've got to go left field. You've got to try something different. And, you know, Tanak's...
Or you could choose the favourite when you've got the first choice.
maybe that would be helpful. Lesson learned and duly noted. So 3-1 down in the standings. We've got 4 events to go, so I'm going to have to really pull this one out of the bag. I think if we, Tanak's been so dominant, let's be honest, 5 wins this year, and 5 very convincing ones as well. Of course, it really should be 6 after what happened in Sardinia. So I think if Ott Tanak is barred, then I've maybe got half a chance there.
Well, I was just going to ask you to give us a prediction for this weekend's Belgian Grand Prix, but I don't know whether they're based in your form. That's a wise idea.
Well, pass. I think it's now or never for Ferrari, isn't it? You know, I mean, they're going into not just one, but 2 very strong races as well. But I think all signs point to another Lewis Hamilton victory, isn't it?
Yes, it does, but let's hope there's a bit of competition.
Absolutely. And that's all we've got time for on Pole Position this week, but we'll be back from next Thursday night to do it all again from 8 o'clock. Thanks very much to Adam, to our guests, and for you to joining us as well. And stay tuned for the Rock Zone coming up next.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.